Well, now to thank you for being interested in history. Now for the first speaker, Jerry LaPierre, Development of Ultraviolet Photoemission, UPS, a History. And you're on.
You
have 20 minutes to talk, and then...
Well, it's good to see all of you here today. And my only qualifications are I'm a living history, so I don't know anything other than that. So I'm delighted with so many faces here. How many of you are graduate students? Well, that's pretty good. How many of you are postdocs? Wow. And how many of you are from Boston College? Boston University, sorry. Well, how many of you never heard of photoemission? No hands? Wow, that's pretty good. Well, several years ago there was a lot of history sessions, and I enjoyed all of them. So I said, well, maybe I'll put a history paper in. And so I'm pleased to see that there are a few sessions this year. Let me start by saying what you might call modern photoemission, or electrons, electron emission induced by photons. It turns out that one origin of this was at General Electric in the late 40s, and I didn't realize that connection to modern photoemission didn't exist until I was asked to give a little historical talk at Bill Spicer's memorial. He died a couple years ago. And for you graduate students, he's a big name in photoemission. How many people here of the graduate students know the name Bill Spicer? That's what I figured. Us old-timers, you know, it's like General MacArthur, we fade away, and nobody remembers us after that. But anyway, Bill was could be called a giant in the development of photoemission. The other well-known source was Kai Siegbahn from Uppsala in Sweden, and he developed photoemission using depends on what your culture, whether they call soft or hard, but typically aluminum magnesium, which photon energy of 12 or 1400 EV nominally. And became world famous, and his friends in Sweden gave him a Nobel Prize a few years ago. He died last summer. And until I started looking into this, I thought he predated Bill Spicer by a long ways, but it turns out he didn't. They're nominally appeared in the same time period. The other sources was an Englishman, and I just didn't write his name down. I just lost it. Do you remember the English guy did gas phase work? Taylor? Huh?
Brundle's advisor.
Dick Brundle did his thesis for. What? You're quite right. Dick Brundle, who was a big name in X-ray photoemission, or ESC as it's called. And he started about the same time, too, around 60. So it turns out that Spicer and GE was probably a little ahead of these people. The English work was really spectacular, and of the old data, the old experiments, it was probably actually the most spectacular and the least known. But they did gas phase, and it is really very good work. I don't know if anybody ever did a history of those. This is Montana State University, where I work, and so I like to show these pictures because I used to use them to recruit Colquhoun speakers, have them come up and take them. All right, so the essential question, in a sense, was to experimentally verify or discover, since you can't calculate them, the solutions of Schrodinger equation. electronic structure, electronic states, and in solids, the electronic states are quite a bit different than it is in the Bohr atom, which you see in all your textbooks. But historically, a way to do that was optically. If you go out very far in the UV, where you get interband transitions between conduction and valence band, the materials are really very optical dense, and you can't. Thank you. So you have to do reflectivity. It's like all these. Oh, maybe it works. This is in David Pines, and there is, for those of you that have really good solid state courses, you maybe know David Pines' book on excitation in solids. What? Probably. He did a lot of things. But I don't know everything he did. Anyway, there's really a set of classic experiments and papers by Herb Philipp and Henry Ehrenreich. Henry was a theorist, and Herb Philipp was an experimentalist. And if you measure the reflectivity, you can do a transform and get the optical constants out, or the dielectric constants, which you probably know are equivalent. You get epsilon 2, and epsilon 2 is basically a measurement of the interband transitions. And so this structure right here is due to interband transition. That's excitations from the conduction band to the valence band, rather conduction band. This is for the indium antimonide. But Philipp measured a whole bunch of different materials, and the basic understanding of these was done by theorist Henry Ehrenreich, who's at Harvard. I think he's still active. But you know that there was a transition that's about 2 volts, but you didn't know what the initial state or the final state was. And it turns out that if you can look at the emitted electron and then measure the kinetic energy of that emitted electron, you can determine the initial state and the final state. And when that was finally realized in the late 50s and early 60s, photoemission was on its way. So sometimes I like to say photoemission is a spectroscopy on a spectra. It's a double spectroscopy. You can vary the photon energy like they did in this experiment, but you can also vary the kinetic energy of the electrons, so you get much more incisive information out than you did optically. Although there are still some advantages. And there was a recent, revival, resonance, renaissance in optical properties, particularly theoretical, in the last 4 or 5 years. Now, let me remind you that you might have remembered in the general physics books, they all talk about the photoemission phenomena. And what you... I didn't get out my writing thing. So we can imagine we need a diode. All photoemission experiments, even the most esoteric one that you can see now, is still a diode. And you let shine here and electrons come off and you collect them over here in this anode. And if the and so there's a current across there, and if these things have the right shape, that current is a function of a applied bias to these things, is an integral energy spectrum in the old nuclear physics sense. Now, the electrons come off with a kinetic energy. So if you want to measure them, you've got to slow them down. So this is the retarding potential. And if you accelerate, you don't get any more current out than this. So this is an IV curve, all two terminal devices. That's all you have, the current versus the voltage across the terminals. If you think in terms of energy space, there's an emitter and a collector. And as you put a retarding bias on, you increase this potential and you cut off part of the current. So if I look at just the derivative in here, I get an energy distribution curve. And so you want to take the curve that's in all textbook, that's Einstein limit, and differentiate it, and you get the kinetic energy distribution. Nowadays, that's done electrostatically, with and sometimes with magnetic analyzers. I have no idea. Am I about halfway yet, or
about halfway?
Got to speed up or slow down.
10 minutes.
So. I'll say a bit more in a minute about the history. This I got from Bill Spicer. Bill Spicer actually constructed this photoemission experiment at RCA sometime in the 50s. And the collector is this can here, cylinder, and inside it, attached to these two wires, is the emitter. And the light comes in through here. And so this is lousy geometry. And the resolving power of this thing was tremendous, about 10 on good days, and maybe more like 8. But there was hundreds of papers published off of this thing. And us people in the field benevolently called this the Spicer beer can. But on this set of leads here was the evaporator, and down here on a bunch of these leads is the, they're still used, is the Italians have a company called SAE, and they make alkali metal evaporators. So down here is sodium, potassium, all that stuff, and GE, of course, made photocells, and we still use them commercially. So evaporated a little antimony and then evaporated these alkali metals and made bialkali cathodes in here. And before you did all that, you evacuated all this and sealed off the tube so it was sealed off. And that's actually a metal film there, antimony film to be specific, which leaked out of the can. But you hid this down here so it didn't fog up your window. And this was the photoemission experiment up through 65 or mid-60s. My comments are only going to go to 65 or the early 60s. This is Bill Spicer, and he's holding one of his tubes there, and he's showing. Bill, help me.
Sebdoniak.
One thing of getting old, you forget names. I know Zeb very well. He came to Bozeman one time, and about an hour after he got off of the plane, they hiked him up on one of the high hills. He lived to get back on the plane to go home, but I thought they might kill him. The way you measure these energy distribution curves, you put a little vibration voltage on the retarding curve and measure the resulting vibrating current, which is the derivative. And you do that all automatically, and here's, you can barely see it, but here's the spectrum. And this is out of one of Bill Spicer's theses. And in those days, one of the things that made UPS useful was this normal instance monochromator. Normal instance means the light comes in, bounces off at very near polar angle. That's a discharge lamp, and this little vacuum chamber that we put the glass tube in. And that was the electronics for differentiating it. And this would work up to about 12 volts, which was a useful energy window, although a very tiny energy window. And so, mid-60s, the technology started to change dramatically, but the UPS had still made an impact. Actually, in my opinion, one of the first contributions Bill Spicer made to this field, he was a real fighter and tenacious with his ideas, and he was tenacious with his right ideas, and he was equally tenacious with his wrong ideas, and that generated a lot of nice discussions in the 60s. But anyway, if you ask somebody about 60 what photoemission was, first of all, they didn't know. Secondly, if they knew something about it, they said it had nothing to do with the emitter. It was all a phenomenon of the surface. And so I think one of Bill Spicer's first contributions was that the emitted current had a relationship to the electronic structure of the emitter. And believe it or not, that was not believed in the early 60s. And I heard Bill get up and argue after question after question, what are you doing? This has got nothing to do with physics. And that's sort of hard to believe now with the thousands and thousands of, probably all of you know, every major university in the world has at least one photoemissioner in it. So it's ballooned out. Anyway, I just talk mostly from here. I was a student at Missouri. Started there in 52 and finished in, in 56, finished in 62. So General Electric was a very prestigious research institution, and it was, in this era, did a lot of PhysRev type research. And there was a group leader there called Apker. And they started some experiments, and the first experiments they did, I thought I had a 10-minute talk, but It's a fact that we still only two. What's what?
3 minutes.
Is that all I got left?
No.
All right. Well, there you go. I'm glad I didn't. I plan on doing too many more coils. Anyway, they did energy resolved, as I call it, photo emission in glass tubes. Probably the earliest paper is 48 or something like that. And so Herb Phillip worked in that group, and he went to Missouri for graduate school and became a buddy of Bill Spicer. And Spicer is a graduate student at Missouri. He graduated about a year before I started there. Didn't do any photo emission, but there was photo emission experiments going on at Missouri that time, and even when I was there, but I didn't do a photo emission experiment there either. But the first year I left Missouri and was a faculty member, I called Bill and said I'd like to come out for the summer, and so he had just joined the faculty at Stanford, and so I went out and joined him there. But a lot of his early viewpoints and interpretations he took out of the optical properties of solids. And he was very stimulated from the optical work done by Herb Phillip. And in 58, I guess I don't even have his name up here, he published the so-called three-step model, which is like the Bohr model of the atom, not quite right, but it's a very useful model for thinking about things and is one of the major contributions in physics. So the modern photo emission, which is synchrotron radiation photo emission, started with Apker and Bill Spicer. Eisenstein was Bill Spicer's thesis director, who were in the middle of Spicer's thesis, died of a heart attack. In those days, electron emission was called physical electronics, and already commented on optical properties, and thermionic emission was a big field there. And those three sort of got together, and various things, which I hope I made a few correct comments, but there's others to be made, started the business of determining electron structure, quantum structure, and leads nowadays to the modern photo emission, synchrotron radiation photo momentum, momentum resolved photo emission. What's the graduate students, what's momentum resolved photo emission mean? Are you awake, dead, or what?
What?
What's momentum resolved photo emission? You're right.
Oh, I know that is, yeah.
So that's where we are. That's very good. You got good students that bossing you.
Well, we,
no, has we, the bell rung?
It has.
Okay. So another old friend of mine, I don't mean the geyser, that's Dave Shirley, who was a player nowadays and in the old days. And if you want some references, the material I put together for this talk is actually written up, but I can't figure out where to publish it. This is a bit of a history, but more technical history. And this is a nice history on synchrotron radiation. And there's one a nice, a big thing that really catapulted at least one part of photo emission is synchrotron radiation, and the little history of the first synchrotron radiation dedicated source in the world is written by Dave Lynch. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Don't you have a comment, Bill?
Yes, if there are.
Well, I would add one thing to the reference. You didn't have time to mention the name of Neville Smith, but Neville Smith was a giant after Phil Spicer. Neville spent most of his technical life at Bell Labs, but then was the director of the photons.
No, I'm glad you made that comment.
At Berkeley. Unfortunately, Neville had passed away early, past couple of years.
Yeah, 2 years ago.
And Steve Caban, who was one of Neville's associates, Steve and somebody else, they put together a memory book of everybody who had worked in photo emission associated with Neville from the 60s up to the present, which there were a lot of one or two page contributions, and that's just a wonderful resource for the history of photo emission over the past 40 years. And Steve Caban is at University of Oregon in the physics department. They had this online, so if anybody's interested,
I think that's superb. The reason I didn't mention all that is I did say my comments didn't go past 62 or 63, and so there was a lot of history between 62 and Neville Smith did a postdoc with Bill Spicer in the late 60s, and about 70 went to Bell Labs, and so Bill's comments are very germane, but that was all that happened about a decade after I quit.
Well, all of
did we have another question?
I don't believe so.
Don't you have a question?
I just wanted to take. I had a comment that
good,
all
thank
of
you.
These names and all of the records should be registered essentially at the Niels Bohr Library at the AIP. So. That they have a record where the references can be gotten. Because it's very, very easy
so
to
I'll try
forget
to
people.
You try to remember. I'll try to remember. We send a note to Caban to have him deposit that.
I'll give you a card so you can email me.
All right.
Okay. Well,
no more questions?
There are no more.
Well, thanks
thank
for everybody. Yeah, young fella.
This also, it may or may not be after your cutoff date, but I'm just wondering, you know when people started also thinking about using photo emission for surface properties, like to look at how can these orbital changes to get to these states, you know, sort of thing?
1970.
That was probably late 60s, actually. Due to Spicer's and all the comment already made, the big emphasis was to prove photo emissions made bulk properties, but the surface properties were there. The first measurement that was well recognized was CO on transition metals done by Dean Eastman. But 3 or 4 years older than that, I did oxygen on alkaline earth metals. Those are probably published like 68 or something. And Spicer did calcium absorption. And I think that's the first chem absorption measurements made. But then the field really shifted to surface science and focused on surface chem absorption problems. But I think all that was in the 70s, and I can't tell you when. I never did a paper count on who did what when. But I think 68 was when my group and Bill's group oxidized alkaline earth metals.
I think we'll have to stop here and go on to the next speaker.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Zimmerman. You were most kind.
Somehow, yeah.
The rest of the speakers are probably all modern and have
Stop.